Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're discussing open enrollment, creditors in your DMs, and falling rents.
Yeah, buddy, this is our Friday Flight episode where we look at the headlines, where we specifically look to the non-political headlines and we figure out how it is that those stories are going to affect us and our money. Because, you know,
hard to find any non-political headlines this week, by the way.
Actually, we have a lot. I was kind of surprised. There's a good amount that was going on this week. But yeah, I mean, that being said, there have been a ton of political news, and they do have an impact here and there on our money. But dude, in the end, there is so much more that we can do ourselves. There are steps that we can take that have nothing to do with politics and policy.
And we actually have like a lot of great stories that are going to actually help people with their personal finances this week on today's episode. So
And that's what we do every Friday, by the way.
Every Friday.
We look at the news and figure out how this has to do with your money.
But before we get to that, real quick, I wanted to let you know that we had a tropical storm come through Atlanta.
I know it.
Just over a week ago.
Yep.
And I had a limb fall down off a tree and bust my rear window in the Nissan Leaf.
You're not sharing this with me. You're sharing this with the listeners.
Sharing with them.
Because I knew that. Sometimes we pretend that we don't know what the other one's about to say. But this is definitely an instance where you sent me that picture that morning. And I was like, oh no, dude, I'm so sorry. Who would have thought that a Category 2 hurricane coming ashore in like New Orleans or wherever it landed was going to equal us losing power for, I mean, basically like multiple days around Halloween.
And when you rode around town, the trees that were down, it was just insane.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. But the amount of wind, man, that took down trees in particular, like in our neighborhoods where we've got these 100-year-old oaks and branches down and all that action. But yeah, the funniest thing though about your story, your windshield, was the insurance conversation that you had.
Yeah, so
with your wife.
Well, like she asked me, well, all right, are we going to file an insurance claim?
Like most people probably think to do, right?
I had multiple neighbors saying the same thing. Oh, I'm sorry about your window. Have you talked to insurance yet? And my response, you know, trying to be the super nice, not too preachy financial guy, like, no, I'm not going to talk to insurance.
Are you crazy?
it's literally, I called up a mobile glass repair guy. He came out within a couple days. He had to order the new windshield, and it was $415 was the total out the door price to get my car back up to
parts
normal.
And labor.
Yeah.
$415. That's nothing.
Not too bad.
Yeah. So,
and a deductible, the minimum deductible on a car is typically either $250 or $500.
Or it should be that much.
Or it should be more. Like, you should have your deductible set even higher, which
I
do.
Not lower. Like, cause some people have it set lower, right? Like around $100 because they think, well, I don't want to have to pay full $400. But the main reason that we do encourage folks to raise those deductibles and pay out of pocket is to avoid making claims with your insurance company in order to keep your premiums low. Because the more often you use it, you have a higher likelihood of seeing your premiums go up. And those increased rates due to maybe higher risk that the insurer perceives for you sticks around for years and years.
Years
way more than just a few $100 now.
That's right. That's right. So I would rather pay it out of pocket, one, because my deductible is higher than the cost of replacing.
You got to sit
replacing
at
the window.
$500?
No, I think my deductible is at $1,000. So
yeah, there you go. That's how you get that real savings.
The highest amount that I can set it.
My deductible is at $5,000.
Sadly, the insurance company won't let you go that high. But yeah, I just wanted to let everybody know that those minor things. Don't even call your insurance company about something that's just a minor accident. Get a quote first to see whether you can afford to replace it on your own. And at the same time, call your insurer and see, well, if I do up my deductible, how much can I save over the next 12 months? And then pocket that savings. Put it in a savings account so you can be prepared for the next possible accident, to where you're essentially self-insured and you can afford to take care of that, you know, busted window or minor scratch on your own.
Yeah, luckily we didn't have any big limbs come down in around our house, but if they had been, I think hopefully we would have avoided a branch, because when in the fall, I tend to park the van out on the street because all the leaves fall on top of the car, man. It gets so filthy. You know, like all the leaves that get down into like the air vents, down into the little trim, and you kind of hit it with a blower and then it like shoots it down further into it. And then it's basically a part of the vehicle at that point. But yeah, man, sorry that happened to you. But at the same time, I'm glad you're able to get that fixed pretty quickly and easily.
Yeah, especially as you're riding around town. I'm riding around on my bike, checking things out, and just so many trees down. cars damaged severely.
Yeah.
Some people had homes damaged, of course. And so, yeah, I feel bad for those people who have like a lot of damage to take care of. A busted windshield, really not that big a deal in the scheme of things.
Yeah, not that big of a deal, man. Let's continue to talk about some of the stories that we came across this week. And let's talk about rent. The pandemic has had a pretty meaningful impact on where people want to live. There have been a lot of stories about people fleeing cities like New York and San Francisco. Maybe you've seen podcast episodes out there saying like, are cities dead? I don't know. It's a question. It's a debate for us. But rents are falling in many U.S. cities right now because of this lack of demand. This makes sense, right? Because, you know, the things that people love about living in these cities has changed dramatically due to COVID. I don't know when there's been this kind of period of time where there weren't Broadway plays going on in New York. I don't think ever. And we saw in Bloomberg that they noted that the average rents in 30 core cities have dropped more than 5%, while average rents in the suburbs of those cities have inched up half a percentage point. Again, in cities like San Francisco and New York, it's even more. I think maybe, you know, it's down more like 15%. And these rent price dynamics have a big impact on how you should proceed if you are a renter, in particular if you're looking at maybe re-signing that lease, or maybe you're looking at a new place.
Yeah, totally. If you're re-signing a lease in the near future, chances are you should be paying a lot less than you were paying last year, especially if you live in one of these core cities. Knowing, for example, that like in Manhattan, Brooklyn, or Queens, that rents have plummeted, and that the new normal for monthly rent is quite a bit less than last year when you sign your lease. That gives you an edge when you're negotiating with your current landlord, or you're looking around, shopping around to find another place to live. Inventory is way up in these locations. So just a couple of tips. Since rents are down, don't get married to a particular building or a unit. Don't get obsessed with one place and decide that you have to have it. The more flexible you can be about the place you're willing to live, the more you can potentially save. And also, too, be flexible about the terms. If a landlord wants, you know, a 6-month or a 1-year, or maybe even like a 2-year lease right now, maybe they're worried about the potential for rents to drop even further in the coming months. Well, the more you can be flexible, the higher likelihood that you'll be able to save money on your rent every month. So obviously we're in an odd time, but yeah, use these falling rent prices to your advantage as a renter.
Yeah, definitely, man. And it's also, I think, worth pointing out to kind of approach some of these stories with a level head. Because I know when I see a story like this, it makes me think, oh, there's an opportunity here. Like, now's the time to live in New York City. But, like, the price, you know, rent prices, it's only one factor. It's only one reason that you should consider moving, if you are considering moving at all. And so, it's again, something you do want to keep in mind. But at the same time, that shouldn't be your only reason to, you know, want to maybe uproot yourself or even your family to someplace totally new. Let's keep moving, man. It's enrollment season when it comes to healthcare, and we want to specifically talk about HSAs, which are health savings accounts. And we saw recently that only 6% of people that contribute to an HSA actually invest inside of it. And this is according to the Employee Benefits Research Institute. That is not good, man.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I would like to see a lot more people actually investing and not just having that money sitting there as cash. Because HSAs are pretty great as a vehicle for paying for current medical necessities while avoiding tax on that money. But HSAs are overwhelmingly excellent if you invest that money for decades instead. Back in episode 105, we discussed HSAs in detail, so check that out if you want all the details. But yeah, especially since we are in the open enrollment season, you know, if your health is in good condition, if you're enrolling in an HSA eligible healthcare plan, and if you want to invest more for the future, go the HSA route. And, you know, don't just actually stick money, stick cash inside that HSA where it sits there as cash. Make sure that you are actually investing the money within that account.
That's right. And two of our favorite companies, by the way, for opening an HSA with are Fidelity and Lively, because of the low fees that they offer and the awesome access to investment options. So we'll link to both of those in our show notes. Last week, we actually talked about changing tax brackets, Matt, and then a minor increase in the amount that people can save in a SEP IRA. I think an additional $1,000 coming up next year.
Yeah, the new IRS guidelines.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? The HSA actually got a little bit of a bump up too.
Oh.
An extra $50, I think it was. So yeah, and $100 for families. So the new HSA contribution limits are $3,600 for individuals and $7,200 for families. And a little extra note too, people over 55, well, they can save an extra $1,000 a year.
Nice.
Too. Yeah. So don't neglect the HSA. You know, Matt and I, we really do think it's one of the best retirement plans out there if you use it correctly, because you're never ever taxed on any of that money, which is why it's so important to not be with the 94% of people who aren't investing inside of it. Be like those 6% of people and start investing inside of your HSA, because it's just one of the best ways to long-term invest for your future.
Yeah, that's right. Pay for those medical expenses out of pocket and try not to touch that HSA money. Treat it more like a retirement account. All right, so there's an awful new debt collector rule, Joel. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, also known as the CFPB, they just finalized a rule this week that will allow debt collectors to contact consumers by email, text, and by social media like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Like, seriously, what is up with that?
Dude, this is such bad news. Consumer Reports, they say that each creditor will be able to have the ability to send an unlimited number of texts, emails, and social media messages to you. So that's where the slide into the DMs title came from that we mentioned.
Like, I'm not already getting enough spam like on social media and in my text message inbox.
It's terrible. Considering, you know, that this is an industry that is like already willing to stoop to some really low levels in order to get paid. This is bad news for those who owe money.
Yeah. And Matt, as it turns out, a lot of Americans do owe money, yeah. Right? According to the National Consumer Law Center, 1 in 4 adults have a bill that is in collections at any given time. So this is going to have an impact on a whole lot of Americans. And the CFPB did say that consumers can opt out of these updated electronic communication methods, but they haven't explained how that's going to be implemented. So, you know, hopefully we'll get an update on that and be able to relay that to everyone, how to avoid debt collectors in your DMs, because it sounds terrible. But even though this is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau who issued this new rule, it certainly doesn't seem like this is a federal bureau that has, at least currently, the interests of Americans as a whole in mind. Matt, back in the day, you and I, we got to interview Richard Cordray, who helped start and found the CFPB.
He was the first director.
Yeah, and his mission was a good one. And he actually did a great job at reining in some of the excesses of the financial services industry and protecting Americans. And right now, the CFPB has lost sight of some of that mission and allowing debt collectors to contact you, you know, via DMs on Twitter or through Facebook Messenger or texting you at all hours of the day. That's just bad news for all of us.
Yeah, like, I understand the need to update communication methods, right? Like, because before this, like, they could only make those phone calls. But at the same time, the fact that they have outlined how often you can be contacted via these, you know, social media platforms, which is unlimited, the fact that they have that outlined and they don't have outlined how it is that you can opt out of, you know, some of this electronic communication just kind of tells you where their priorities are.
Right. Yeah.
In my opinion.
Agreed.
So the next steps, you know, for if you have debt in collections, first of all, luckily this rule doesn't go into effect for another year. So there's a chance maybe it can be changed before then. But regardless, if you're being contacted by a creditor today, you know, by the phone, or if it's by Instagram next year, you always want to make sure that you verify that the debt is actually yours. Because of the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act of 1977, you have the right to ask for the debt collector to provide you with details of how they calculated and arrived at the total debt that they're trying to collect from you, you know, as well as the name of the original creditor who you owed. And so this is an important step since collection agencies incompetence, you know, or sometimes they just don't care. That means that they might be seeking a debt from someone maybe just with a similar name as yours, or maybe they have the wrong person altogether. They're barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, and I just want to mention too that obviously debt collectors have a job to do, and there's a lot of people that do owe a legitimate debt, and
yes,
they should pay that debt. It's just that this is an industry that sometimes goes to excess when it comes to collecting debts, and sometimes they violate the law.
Yeah, we're not against people paying their debts, but we're maybe against the harassment of individuals in particular, yeah, when the law is being broken.
Yeah, exactly.
I hate that.
Wanted to mention that, and hopefully we get a little more information on how you can protect yourself from a social media harassment campaign from debt collectors if you actually do owe a debt. All right, Matt, one other thing. Speaking of folks reaching out to you via text, there have been some reports of new stimulus check text message scams. Obviously, there isn't a new round of stimulus checks, not yet at least. And so if you receive a text or email saying otherwise, don't click on that link. It might be tempting because you're like, wait, money coming my way?
I want some.
That sounds great. I can use it, right?
Yeah.
But it's not legit. And it just reminds me of our recent conversation with Carol Theriault recently on cybersecurity. Listen back to that one if you haven't already for some great tips to keep you and your money safe, because you know these sorts of scams, this sort of intrusion into your email inbox and into where you hang out in social media, it's just becoming more of the norm. And she had some great thoughts on how you can protect yourself and your money. All right, Matt, we got more to get to, including a new interesting survey on who owes the most when it comes to student loans. We'll get to that and more right after this break.
All right, we are back, and we have a whole slew of additional stories that we're going to get to. Joel, let's talk about working from home. We want to make sure that individuals out there, that you're being careful, that you're not working too much if you're one of the millions of folks who are now working from home.
Oh, don't worry about me, Matt. I'm not.
I've got no worries at all that you're working too much.
We're talking about other people. They could fall prey to working too much.
That's true. But some folks I know have somewhere between 2 and even 3 hours back in their day, thanks to not having to get ready for work, thanks to not having to commute.
Yeah, and we live in the great city of Atlanta, where commutes are off the wall crazy.
It's a real thing, and so for most folks, it's more like probably under an hour of found time. Even that's nice, but many workers are now using a lot of that time that is now theirs that they've reclaimed, right? But they're taking that and they're dedicating it to their employer.
Lame.
They're working more. The University of Chicago did a study recently to see where people's extra hours are going. And it looks like more than 1/3 of the hours that people aren't spending on their commute are being spent working. And so this is something we want to point out, because I think in some situations, if you want to work more, that's fine, right? I mean, in particular, if you bill hourly, like that means you're probably getting paid more. Or if you want to maybe get ahead at work, working more is, you know, that's a good thing to do. But it's about being aware of the fact that this might be happening to you and you may not even realize it, right? Like it used to leave for work at 7, and maybe you didn't start working though until like 7:45 or 8. But now you're still used to, you know, leaving the house, quote unquote, leaving the house at 7. And so you start working at 7, and then you take that, you multiply that times 2. That's a lot of time, a lot of additional time that's going towards work.
Yeah, yeah. And that same University of Chicago study revealed that childcare obviously makes that list as well for a lot of people. They're spending a lot more time with their kids facilitating in-home learning, or some of their kids maybe haven't been able to go back to daycare. And so, yeah, you are spending a lot more time with your kids, and it's become harder to work. But a lot of people are working more. And I think it made sense too, Matt, particularly in the beginning of the lockdown, that people were working more, right? We were all trying to kind of get our bearings and figure out how working from home would actually work out in our lives. But most of us at this point have developed a bit of a rhythm. So it's important to make sure that you create some barriers between you and your work so that you're not overworking yourself just because your laptop is right there in your house. And I think that's what people can easily and have easily fallen prey to. And Matt, in episode 182, we talked about, you know, some tips to help people work from home effectively. And a couple of things we mentioned was having a dedicated workspace, which means not working from your bed, right? and not working from the kitchen table in all likelihood either. Having a called out space in your house where you get work done. And then having hard work hours, making sure you know when you're on and off the clock and not deviating from that can really help you to create proper barriers and avoid overworking just because your work is essentially in your house now.
Yeah, having a dedicated time to work as well as a dedicated space to work is ideal.
Yeah, and taking a couple breaks too during the day. I think when people work from home, sometimes they forget the rhythms of a normal work day when they were in the office. And there were break times built in there too, right? A walk down the hall, a visit to see a coworker. And so take that break, step outside, whatever it takes to get yourself clear-headed and refreshed to kind of get back at it.
You miss that walk down to the break room where you reach in there and grab yourself a Coca-Cola every afternoon?
Always.
So we've talked about authorized user status before, right, with credit cards, how this can be a good way to help lift your credit score. So, for example, maybe you handled credit cards poorly in college, but now you're on the right track, and a family member adds you to their card in order to extend their good credit to you. Well, we've never talked about this before, but you can add your very young children as authorized users in order to give them, you know, a bit of a jump start on establishing great credit. And by very young, I mean even babies. I just added our one-year-old to one of my credit cards. Actually, like I added all 4 of the kids to that card in order to kind of get them set up for, you know, a nice long history of good credit.
Yeah, and I think if you handle credit incredibly well, you can set your kids up for, you know, at least a good start in the credit realm.
Yeah.
And that can be a good way to go. And obviously, you're not planning on your kids, especially your one-year-old, using that card anytime soon, right? But because they'll have that solid and long history of on-time payments and low utilization, when they are old enough to get a card in their own name as an adult, that means they'll be in a super solid position. And speaking of being old enough too, Matt, different credit card issuers have different age requirements in order to be added as an authorized user. Some cards like the Blue Cash Preferred, which you've talked about a bunch, they've got a minimum age of 13. So your one-year-old, not going to qualify. But obviously you used a different card. Which one did you use so that your kids who are all under 13 were able to qualify?
So my Capital One Quicksilver card.
There you go.
Which is a card I use for all of my online purchases that happen on a recurring basis. So I've got one specific card that I use for online subscriptions, basically. And that's all I use that card for.
And so they don't have any age limit, so you're good to any kid.
Literally added a 1 through a 7-year-old, got them added, and those cards are on their way. But obviously, yeah, like those aren't cards that they're going to use, but they're going to be able to kind of piggyback off of my proper usage of credit in order to get them set up.
Can you imagine the thank you that you're going to receive in 20 years when they find out how you've set them up?
Honestly, just how much you and I talk about money, they're going to roll their eyes. Like, oh, of course you did that, Dad.
Don't care. Leave me alone.
But yeah, I mean, if you have younger kids, that's definitely something to consider. You know, if you are going to handle your credit well, that's something that you can extend to them as early as 1-year-old.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Matt, let's talk about 529 plans too.
Yeah, speaking of kids, let's keep the ball rolling.
Let's do it. And yeah, 529 plans are a great way to invest for your child's future, for their schooling. And in particular, 529 plans are typically used for paying for college expenses. And Morningstar recently made changes to their 529 plan ratings. Morningstar is this fantastic site that provides awesome financial reporting and content. They also rate funds that you can invest in. Also, they rate 529 plans from each state, and some are better than others, right? The disparity in fees and investment choices vary from state to state, and it can be a meaningful difference between each one. And for this year, Morningstar has rated Utah, Illinois, and Michigan as having the top plans out there. We'll link directly to those top-rated plans in our show notes, along with the full Morningstar ratings, but we wanted you to know that because where you invest for your kids, which state's plan that you decide to partake in when you're saving for their college future, it matters. It's going to have a big difference in the ultimate outcome of how much you're able to put away for them.
Yeah, those states that do really well are must be states that Sufjan Stevens likes. Well, not Utah, I guess, but Illinois and Michigan.
Man, if he created a Utah album, I would listen to it.
Yeah, and most people interested in signing up for a 529 plan don't know a couple of important things, right? First of all, you don't have to sign up with your state's plan, with the state where you live. If the state you live in has a poorly rated plan, you can invest through one of the top rated ones instead. Also, how it is that you go about signing up for one of these 529 plans, that matters as well, right? You could open that account up through your local bank, but chances are that's going to be a bad move because they typically have a lot of fees associated with those accounts. Instead, we would recommend for you to open up your plan online directly through the state's link. And that's going to be the best way that you can make sure to avoid any of those additional fees that could easily be avoided. Also, too, if your state has a state tax benefit, there's a good chance that you'll want to invest in your state's plan, maybe instead of the plans that, rank the highest. So, for example, our Georgia plan is rated neutral, which isn't super great. There's like gold, silver, and bronze, and then it's just kind of like the meh category. It's not negative, at least, but it's just kind of neutral. But we've got some state tax benefits that they offer. And so that will more than make up for some of its minor inadequacies. We may not have the best investing options available through the Georgia plan, but those additional state tax benefits are going to easily be able to make up for that, those shortcomings.
Yeah, for sure. So again, we'll link to all that stuff in the show notes, the Morningstar ratings, and it's just helpful if you're thinking about starting to save and invest for your kids' future. A 529 plan is a great way to do this. You just want to make sure you're doing it the right way. And I think that guide can be helpful. All right, Matt, let's talk about student loans on the note of paying for college. Who owes the most in student loans?
And doctors.
Probably doctors.
Lawyers.
Yeah, that's a good point. They do. And they probably are not laughing while we're laughing.
Is that what you're asking? Or are you specifically talking about demographic?
Yeah, demographic. So Fidelity actually just came out with a new survey. You might be surprised, but it's baby boomers that actually owe the most when it comes to student loans. So this new report gives that insight. And this is primarily due to Parent Plus loans, and parents of college-age kids taking on a large chunk of their kids' debt burden for them. This is bad news, I think, Matt, for so many reasons. One, many boomers can't afford the debt that they're taking on, especially as they get nearer to retirement. It's like this albatross that they can't get out from under as they're nearing their retirement years. And the average interest rate on these Parent Plus loans is higher too. So parents, whatever you do, if you've got kids going to college or nearing college, we suggest avoiding Parent Plus loans at all costs. They're bad, bad news. And there are other ways around it. In particular, trying to help your kid find a cheaper place to go to school. If Parent Plus loans have to be part of the equation, it's just not worth it.
Yeah, there are other alternatives as well. Making sure that you apply for as many scholarships as possible, maybe scoring some grants, and even working through college are all things that we would recommend over just signing on that dotted line, you know, and saddling yourself, you know, your kids, but then also your, you know, you as parents with sometimes some overwhelming debt.
Yeah.
And student loan debt, you know, like this is obviously an issue in our country. Estimates are that we're nearing $1.7 trillion in overall debt for higher education. And everyone should be way more careful before they take out this kind of debt. And Joel, actually on Monday, we're publishing an episode that is going to be making an argument for avoiding higher education altogether and how instead a lot of folks should consider maybe the skilled trades. For a lot of individuals, I think college has kind of become the default option, but instead there are some legitimate alternate routes that people can take. I'm actually really excited about the interview that we've got slotted for Monday. So yeah, look forward to that.
Yeah, read the book. It's called Blue Collar Cash by Ken Rusk. Awesome book. So much good information. And look forward to having that conversation with him because I do think it's something that people should think about more, especially when you look at the overall student loan debt burden of Americans as a whole. And then as you look to see that it's impacting just the baby boomer generation the most, people who just can least afford to bear these student loans. Taking on that kind of debt as you're looking to wind down your working career is a bad recipe. Yeah, and I think that conversation is going to be super enlightening. All right, Matt. Well, that's going to be it for this episode then. We'll have a link to the articles and the resources we mentioned in our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com.
Yeah, and if you're listening and you found this episode, if you found this show overall very helpful to you and your money, we would be incredibly thankful if you head over to Apple Podcasts and if you left us a solid review over there. And if you've already done that, you know what? Let a friend know about our show. Help us to get the word out and help others to start making smarter moves with their money. So Joel, that's going to be it, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.